Well, good evening, and thank you all for coming out this evening on a time when you might have had other extracurricular activities. I will try not to horrify you too much in what I have to say about Iraq and the U.S. presidential election. I want to start off by talking about what I see as the disjuncture between the discourse about Iraq in the Washington political arena and the realities of Iraq on the ground. And I think it's almost inevitable that there should be such a difference, because many of the talking points and campaign promises that were put forward a year ago, and which the candidates have stuck to, and you know, nowadays in campaigns you can't change your talking points or you're a flip-flopper. They addressed Iraq at a different stage of its political development. A year ago, the Iraqi army was nothing to write home about. It couldn't actually get anything done on the ground very much. It couldn't take and hold territory. And in May, it actually made some progress in this regard down in cities like Basra and Amara, and even in East Baghdad. So things changed. It got better equipped, it got better trained, the prime minister finally got control of it to some extent. And so, you know, you might have said a year ago, and I probably would have said a year ago, that U.S. troops would be necessary in Iraq for some time just to keep the place from falling apart. And yet, maybe that's not so true now. But the talking points that we hear from our politicians haven't changed to recognize this change on the ground. So let me just go through briefly what I see as the main positions taken by the candidates, and then I'm going to come back and talk about what I think is really going on in Iraq in that context. Senator John McCain of Arizona maintains that the troop escalation is called the surge, but I don't like euphemisms. People don't pass away, they die. So the troop escalation of 30,000 extra troops that were put in spring of 2007 and into 2008 is attributed, the decline in violence in Iraq is attributed to that troop escalation by McCain. McCain says that victory is possible. He says that there has been political progress in Iraq, and he points to specific laws that have been passed. For instance, last February, the Iraqi parliament finally passed a law revising the sanctions that had been placed on members of the old Ba'ath party under Saddam Hussein. And these, of course, had been punished. They had been excluded from government jobs in very large numbers and so forth. And this law was intended to redress some of that, to change the punitive character of the laws with regard to the members of the Ba'ath Party. Many of those so punished had been Sunni Arabs, and so the punitive policies towards the Ba'ath also then helped to alienate many of the more capable Sunni Arabs, and that law was revised. However, the ex-Ba'athists in the Iraqi government, Iyad Alawi, the former interim prime minister, is among them, roundly denounced this law that McCain praised. And if the people that the law was intended to mollify are alarmed by it, then it's not actually probably contributing to social peace. And if you look into it, the actual law that was passed forbids ex-Ba'athists to work for several ministries, would cause them to be fired from places that they now are. It's a much more problematic law than Senator McCain gave it credit for. He does not envisage a complete withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq. He talks about Iraq in analogies. So sometimes it's like South Korea, and sometimes it's like post-war Germany and Japan, and we historians disapprove of that kind of thing, because historical analogy is deploying it as like nailing Jell-O to the wall. And of course, Iraq is not actually very much like Germany, Japan, or South Korea. But McCain, just as after the Korean War was over, the United States kept bases in South Korea, and several divisions, actually, up until fairly recently. I think there were 40,000 troops there. McCain envisages a couple of divisions, apparently, remaining in Iraq, and long-term U.S. bases. And when challenged on this at one point at a campaign rally, Senator McCain said, well, you know, what the American people really mind is that our troops are being killed in violent action in Iraq. If there were social peace, if the troops were not actually dying, then why would anybody care if we had bases in Iraq? After all, I think Chalmers Johnson estimates that we have 800 bases around the world, and you don't see a lot of demonstrations in the United States against those bases. So McCain is saying, you know, there could be long-term bases in the United States, assuming that the war ended, that there was no longer ongoing military operations. Then McCain says it's necessary to keep U.S. troops in Iraq. It's necessary to have those long-term bases. He's not advocating that the current troop level, you know, it's not necessary that we have 150,000 troops in Iraq. It could be apparently 30,000. But it's necessary that there be a troop presence. Why? Because if we just up and withdraw all of our troops from Iraq, he says, Al-Qaeda would take over Iraq. And then it would use Iraq as a staging ground for attacks on the United States. This particular assertion is among the things that I object to most, just on factual grounds. First of all, there is very little or no true Al-Qaeda in Iraq. The U.S. military has tended to call any Sunni Arabs that oppose U.S. presence in Iraq Al-Qaeda. There was no Al-Qaeda in Iraq before the U.S. invasion of the country. It was ruled by a secular Arab nationalist party, the Ba'ath Party. And actually, the U.S. government has posted a few of the documents that it has captured from the Iraqi bureaucracy after the war. And I saw one of these on the web. Senator Rick Santorum urged that some of these be released so that the right-wing bloggers and Arabists could go through them and demonstrate that the war had been necessary. But it backfired because some of the documents released were sort of like how to make an atomic bomb, and probably it was unwise to put those up on the internet. And then one of the documents that was released that I saw was proof positive that there was no connection between the Iraqi regime and Abu Musab Zarqawi. Zarqawi, which was a Jordanian, and he, in 1989, left Jordan. He was a Muslim fundamentalist, and he went to Afghanistan to fight the Soviets. But, you know, he got there just as they had all left. So then he had no fighting to do. He started a newsletter. And he also engaged in a kind of feud with Osama bin Laden. And was of no particular import. He had a Jordanian organization called Monotheism and Holy War, which was illegal in Jordan, and he was actually jailed in the 90s in Jordan for a while. And then he had also organized some Jordanian expatriates in Germany. And at one point in Germany, Al-Qaeda made a fundraising appeal, And Zarqawi forbade his followers to give money to Al-Qaeda. And then after September 11th, Zarqawi comes to Iraq, to the Kurdish regions, which were not under Saddam Hussein's control. And then in sort of May of 2002, there were a lot of reports from the U.S. side that Zarqawi was in Baghdad. So Colin Powell, Dick Cheney, a lot of Bush administration officials came out and said in the buildup to the Iraq war, Zarqawi was in Baghdad, he was given hospital treatment, he was the guest of the Ba'ath regime, Saddam Hussein sent him roses every day, and this proves that Al-Qaeda is active in Iraq and Saddam Hussein was behind 9/11. I mean, the lapses of logic and evidence were enormous here. Zarqawi was not Al-Qaeda, didn't get along with bin Laden, he had nothing to do with 9/11, and Saddam Hussein did not in fact have anything to do with him. So I found one of these documents that was released. What did it say? It was from the Iraqi secret police, and it was a circular that went around to the heads of various departments in Iraq. It said, "We have heard that it's possible that a very dangerous terrorist named Abu Musab Zarqawi, who may be linked to the Saudi terrorist Osama bin Laden, may have entered Iraq." This is an all-points bulletin. It says, if he's here, find him and arrest him. And it includes his picture, and it advises that they shake down the Jordanian community in Iraq, because if Zarqawi was around, he would be in contact with them, so they should try to find him. This document is dated August of 2002. It's 4 months after Colin Powell and Dick Cheney are alleging that Zarqawi was being treated to this wonderful hospital treatment at Saddam's hands. Not only was he not in Baghdad, not only was he not gathering his people under Saddam's aegis and being treated nicely, but the Iraqi secret police were trying to find him and were very worried that he may have entered Iraq at that time. So Zarqawi later on led this monotheism and holy war group as part of the insurgency against the United States once U.S. had invaded Iraq. But it was one small group. And at one point, General Rick Lynch came out and said that 90% of the violence in Iraq was being caused by Zarqawi. Well, what is he, Lex Luthor? You had bombings in Mosul, 600 miles north of Baghdad. You had bombings in Baghdad. You have in Diyala. You have in Al Anbar. How is this one guy running around doing all that every day? It's impossible. It's like I have a friend who used to be Green Beret in Vietnam, and he said in Nam, you know, in the late 60s, if after a battle, if it was dead and it was Asian, then it was VC. They kited the bodies as VC. So it's the same thing in Iraq. If it's Sunni Arab and it's fighting you, then it's Al-Qaeda. So, you know, at some points, the United States has had 26,000 Iraqis in custody. Of these, over two-thirds were Sunni Arabs. That tells me we were fighting Iraqi Sunni Arabs. That was the enemy. And at any one point, we only had 150 foreigners in custody, none of them Iranians. The proportions changed over a time, but apparently the North Africans are extremely angry at us. Well, if it's only 150, you know, Al-Qaeda is an international organization. If Al-Qaeda is active in Iraq, why would we find so few foreign fighters? And you could say, well, maybe there's a differential in the capture rate, but what, did they run faster? So we were fighting Sunni Arabs, Iraqis. And actually, among the largest of and most important of the cells that were fighting us were cells of the Ba'ath Party. Is it Ibrahim Duri, who was a right-hand man of Saddam Hussein, organized a Ba'athist cell near Mosul and was running operatives against the U.S., blowing things up and so forth? And Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, the Pentagon spokesman, DeRita, all of those people, nobody ever came out and said, well, you know, among our big problems in Iraq is we're still fighting the Ba'ath. Because that would make the United States look bad. A, we're fighting Iraqis in Iraq. B, we still are fighting Ba'athists 5 years later. So it's all Al-Qaeda. Why couldn't Al-Qaeda take over Iraq? And you know, McCain went beyond Dick Cheney, because Cheney said that Al-Qaeda might take over the Sunni Arab areas of Iraq. And that's also unlikely. Let us say highly unlikely. But at least, you know, there's some logic to the fear. But Al-Qaeda is a radical, hyper-Sunni organization. It hates Shiites. It's been involved in massacres of Shiites, and Shiites hate it. So unlike the old Ba'ath Party, which was Arab nationalist and it could have members of various religious groups, it could have Shiites, Sunnis, although the Sunnis predominated at the upper levels. It could have even Christians. But it had a wider social base because it was a secular nationalist party. Al-Qaeda is not like that. You can't, you know, like convince some of the Shia to join in with Al-Qaeda. This would be like getting, you know, a large African-American contingent of the KKK. Not going to happen. So the idea that the Shiites, who are a majority, who are 60% of the population, would put up with being ruled by Al-Qaeda is ridiculous. And then the Kurds don't like Al-Qaeda. The Kurds are in the north of Iraq and are, well, Jalal Talabani, one of the leading Kurdish members, is a member of the Socialist International. Note, a socialist is a close ally of the Republican Party. So the Kurds don't like Al-Qaeda. They're not fundamentalists for the most part. So then they're 80% of the population. How are they going to put up with Al-Qaeda ruling them? And you know, Saddam, okay, was a minority regime and he ruled Iraq, but he had tanks, he had helicopter gunships, and people thought he had poison gas. But all that stuff is gone now. How would exactly Al-Qaeda in Iraq rule the whole country in the absence of that war materiel? And then think about it. Shiite Iran is right next door. Shiite Iran is very happy about the Shiite fundamentalist parties ruling Baghdad. So they're going to let their allies be overthrown by Al-Qaeda? And Iranians are petrified of Al-Qaeda. They almost went to war against the Taliban in 1998 in Afghanistan. So, and then the Turks are secularists. They're not going to put up with Al-Qaeda ruling Iraq. The Jordanians actually helped kill Abu Musab Zarqawi in spring of 2006. They're not going to put up with it. So nobody inside Iraq or outside Iraq is going to put up with an Al-Qaeda-ruled Iraq. So the fact is the United States military does not need to be in Iraq to prevent Al-Qaeda from taking over the country. And to say this is just a fantasy. I mean, it really is, you know, like being worried that the Waco group around David Koresh is about to take over Washington, D.C. It's incredible that somebody should say such a thing. Then McCain's running mate, Sarah Palin, when she went to a ceremony sending off U.S. troops to Iraq, said that they were going off to defend the innocent from the enemies who planned and carried out and rejoiced in the death of thousands of Americans. Well, the Iraqis didn't plan and carry out 9/11. I actually don't think probably any significant number of them rejoiced in it either. When pressed on this seeming attempt to tie Iraq once again inaccurately to 9/11, she said that she was not referring to Saddam, but to Al-Qaeda in Iraq. The problem with that is, as I have mentioned, not much in the way of al-Qaeda in Iraq. And it's not, you know, what we call, what the U.S. military calls al-Qaeda in Iraq, is Iraqi Sunni Arabs who ex post facto have called themselves al-Qaeda. It's sort of, you know, it's Halloween today, so we can say it. It's like declaring you're a boogeyman. You know, it's not that there's an operational connection for the most part. Then she says that, Palin says, the victory in Iraq is finally in sight. And it's been pointed out by many observers that neither Senator McCain nor Governor Palin typically says what they mean by victory and why it is in sight. It's a slogan. And then she also at one point said that the U.S. may need to hit Pakistan unilaterally, which raised some eyebrows because Senator Obama has said that as part of his brief against al-Qaeda, but Senator McCain had criticized Obama for saying it. Turning to Senator Barack Obama, he had hoped for an early withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq. He actually suggested 2010 as a cutoff point. And on a strict timetable. So come hell or high water, Mosul and Basra are falling apart, there's violence or there's not violence, the U.S. troops would come out. He does reserve the right to consider the situation on the ground, he says. But for the most part, the emphasis in his campaign has been on setting a timetable for withdrawal and sticking to it. Does not envisage long-term U.S. bases in Iraq, but does talk about having troops remain in Iraq to perform certain specific functions, for instance, guarding the U.S. embassy. And he also talks about getting combat troops out of Iraq, but not necessarily logistical troops. I actually wouldn't advise keeping troops in Iraq without the combat troops. I think they would get blown up. I think it's also the case that, you know, he talks about being willing to strike at al-Qaeda in Iraq, and he means by this just the Sunni fundamentalists, if they were to reemerge as powerful. Well, how exactly would you strike at them if you didn't have troops in Iraq? Well, you could try to send Tomahawk missiles on them, but then Clinton tried that with Osama bin Laden, and it didn't work very well. It turns out, you know, people who live in tents can move them. There's a real problem with sending U.S. troops in on, we could send special ops forces in by helicopter. But I'm told by my friends in special forces, that special operations, that although they are very brave people, and they have done very brave things for the United States, none of them would be willing to go into a combat situation in the absence of some fairly strong assurances that if something went wrong, they could be rescued. So you know, when the United States invaded Afghanistan in fall of 2001, we actually did send troops into Kandahar, but we got the Pakistanis to give us a base at Abbottabad, which was an old British Air Force base, and we sited rescue teams there. So if anything went wrong, we'd be able to send helicopters over and rescue the guys. So where exactly would the rescue teams be sited? Would it be in Kuwait? Would it be in Kurdistan? Wouldn't that be too far away, really, to be effective? So my own view is that Obama, the general contours of Senator Obama's talking points about Iraq hedge a little bit too much. And I think you either have to be in or out. You can't be halfway in. You can't imagine keeping some non-combat troops in Iraq. You can't imagine sending special ops forces into a situation where if something went wrong, there would be no way to effectively rescue them. I think that militarily speaking, these talking points don't really hang together very well. And I also don't think that it's wise to give the impression that the U.S. Would get out of Iraq on a very strict timetable, because Iraq is at the head of the Persian Gulf, and the Persian Gulf, whether we like, you know, I know you all hate petroleum now. You seem to put a lot of it in your automobiles, but you hate it. You despise, it's like an addiction, you know, you despise what you're addicted to, and you hate your dealer, and so forth. And you wonder where all your money has gone at the end of the month. And I'm sympathetic to your hatred for the petroleum, but until solar is not like 7 times more expensive, I'm afraid you may be stuck with it for a while. And 40% of it comes out of the Persian Gulf. And if you don't like $4 a gallon gasoline, you would really, really hate $20 a gallon gasoline. So it's not, you know, I'm sure Vietnam is a nice country. I haven't been there. But it could fall to the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese without that affecting the world economy very much. I think some U.S. rubber interests may have been harmed in 1975. But aside from that, things went on. But the Persian Gulf can't fall to massive violence, guerrilla warfare, pipeline sabotage, Shiite-Sunni fighting, and so forth, without that having an effect on the wider world, because it is, the Persian Gulf is such a big center of world energy. Nearly 2/3 of the world's proven petroleum reserves are in the Gulf, and nearly half of natural gas that we know about in the world. And many of the reserves outside of the Persian Gulf and Central Asia are very shallow. So Mexico is now, I think, our third largest supplier of petroleum. But 10 years from now, it's not clear we'll get any petroleum from Mexico. They have shallow reserves, they're drawing them down, and plus they're starting to drive more and use more of them themselves. Over time, the U.S. will be more dependent and not less dependent on Middle Eastern petroleum. I know that all your politicians are promising you energy independence in 10 years, but I'd just like to remind you that I was around as a young person in 1968 when Nixon started promising energy independence, and we're much more energy dependent now than then. So it's not plausible that a sitting president would march the troops out of Iraq no matter what. And I, you know, there's this old saying in military affairs that no war plan ever survived first contact with the enemy. And none of these campaign promises is going to survive first sitting in the chair in the Oval Office either. Just to remind you that Iraq is a country that has demographic zones. The green part in the south is largely Shiite and Arabic speaking. The white part in the center west is largely Sunni Muslim and Arabic speaking. And the brown part in the north is largely Kurdish. The Kurds are Muslim, mostly Sunni Muslim, although there are all kinds. And they speak an Indo-European language, ultimately related to English. So there are mixed areas. There are some 300,000 Sunnis down near Basra and Zubair. Baghdad is mixed, or at least used to be. And so the map is a little bit misleading, and I think it has misled some of our politicians, because you couldn't actually, Joe Biden, I'm going to tell you, suggested dividing Iraq into a soft partitioning it, not dividing it into 3 countries, but dividing it into 3 big provinces with a weak federal government over top of it. I should say that when Senator Biden put this idea forward of a soft partition of Iraq, that it met with a very negative response from virtually everybody in Iraq. Possibly some of the Kurds behind the scenes didn't mind so much because it's what they would like. But most Iraqis denounced it. And you know, there's something a little bit paternalistic about it. It was first suggested by Les Gelb at the Council for Foreign Relations, a longtime New York Times correspondent. And it's sort of like, you know, when you go on a family vacation and you've got three kids in the back and they're picking at each other. And what do? You say, Joey, you go and sit on that side, and you separate them. So this partition, soft partition plan is, well, the Iraqis are not getting along, so the United States would separate them. But in fact, when this plan was put forward, virtually every member of parliament, of the elected Iraqi parliament, stood up and denounced poor Joe Biden as plotting the demise of the unity of the Iraqi nation. And even if anybody actually wanted what he's talking about, they wouldn't be allowed to say so publicly. And moreover, the parties that are kind of interested in a little bit of this, the Kurds and then some of the fundamentalist Shiites who could imagine a Shiite super province in the south, which would have a lot of petroleum, are not the majority of Iraqis. And most of the parties, even the majority of parliamentarians, are in favor of a fairly strong central government. And Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki is one of those who favors a strong central government. The other thing to say about Biden's plan is that at the time that he actually proposed it, it might have been possible that the U.S. would have something to say about all this. But now? I mean, wouldn't the body that did a soft partition of Iraq be the Iraqi parliament? And they don't want it. It would never pass. And how exactly would the U.S., which whoever is president, the troops are going to be withdrawn in some measure, how would it impose a soft partition on Iraq? So it's something that you could go to al-Maliki and say, well, I think it would be a good idea if you did this, but it's no longer in the gift of the United States to impose this on Iraq. So it doesn't make much sense as a policy talking point, since we can't actually even do it. Well, having laid out what I see as some of the main talking points of our politicians about Iraq, let me turn to how I see the situation there now and what the policy implications are of that situation. Those elections of 2005 in January and then again in December for the national parliament were won by the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq and its allies. I knew this at the time, but I couldn't get through to most of the American public that this is what was happening. Now, the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq, I know them, they're perfectly nice people. I have nothing against them winning the election. But it just should be recognized that they were founded by Ayatollah Khomeini, and until recently at least, are a Khomeinist party. They believed in clerical rule. They were working for the establishment of a Shiite Islamic state. And I was widely criticized in January of 2005 for not being enthusiastic about their victory at the polls. Remember all the purple fingers and how it was so wonderful, and it was 65% turnout and so forth? Well, it was good that an Iran-backed Shiite fundamentalist organization founded by Ayatollah Khomeini had taken over Iraq. Why? And its main ally in 2005 was the Dawah Party, the Islamic Call or the Islamic Mission Party. Much more lay. It's not dominated by clerics. But also founded in the late 50s, explicitly with the goal of establishing an Islamic state in Iraq, instituting Sharia or Islamic law as the law of the land. And that is the social program of these two parties. Is Islamic law should be the law of the land in Iraq. And in fact, they went on to enshrine in the Iraqi constitution that they wrote, because they dominated parliament, in the summer of 2005, the principle that the Iraqi parliament may enact no civil legislation that contravenes Islamic law. It would be as though we had a constitutional convention, Pat Robertson attended and persuaded people that the United States Congress would not be allowed to legislate anything that contradicted the book of Leviticus. Now, there are social forces in the United States that would think that's a good thing, and I'm not actually instancing it as good or bad. I'm simply explaining what the Iraqi situation is. And I don't find a widespread consciousness that the United States presided over the takeover of Iraq by these Shiite fundamentalist parties, or what their, I mean, the religious right kind of aspect of their social policies is. In fact, it's widely, I see these reports in the newspaper or in the blogosphere about how the U.S., you know, liberated Iraqi women. And all the Iraqi women that I know, actually existing Iraqi women, are fit to be tied when they hear this kind of talk. Because, you know, for all of its sins, and it had many, the Ba'ath Party was a secular party, and it was a socialist-tinged party, and especially in the 70s, it did a lot for women's education and women entering the professions. And there were a lot of smart Ba'athi lawyers, some of whom the U.S. used after it took over Iraq. And now, you know, in a lot of Shiite Iraq, women are afraid to go out. They have to veil if they go out. They've been attacked for not veiling properly, and so on and so forth. And women's education has been harmed. So the United States has turned Iraq radically towards the right. And in a patriarchal tradition, it hasn't liberated Iraqi women. And much on the contrary. In fact, there was a joke making the rounds in Iran that they asked an elderly Ayatollah, they said, "Do you think the Bush administration is going to invade Iran?" He said, "No." He said, "The Americans invaded Afghanistan and they installed an Islamic Republic in Afghanistan. Then they invaded Iraq and they installed an Islamic Republic in Iraq. We've had an Islamic Republic since 1979. There is no need for them to invade us." Among many shoes have dropped in Iraq, there's been enormous social violence on an unimaginable scale. I think the public health people who have projected as many as 1 million dead. Excess deaths, that is to say, if you took a baseline of violent death in Iraq in 2000-2001 and you compared it to what happened after the U.S. invasion, you would find that 1 million more people have died in violence since then than you would have expected according to the baseline. I find that entirely plausible. And you have to figure that wounded to deaths must be 3 to 1. So that would be 3 million wounded. Enormous numbers of orphans, widows, and the UNICEF and CARE are estimating on the order of 4.5 million displaced, 2.7 million internally displaced. And we're talking about homeless people here, people who have lost their property, people who are living in tents, no good water, children dying of diarrhea, and then another as many as 1.5 to 2 million in Syria, Jordan, Egypt, and Lebanon. I went and did some research in Jordan this past summer amongst them. This is a human tragedy of unimaginable scale. And it wasn't all caused directly by U.S. troops. The public health studies suggest that about a third of the people who died in violence were killed by U.S. military action, a lot of them by aerial bombardment, because we went on bombarding Iraqi cities even after we had occupied them to put down militias and so forth. So lots of shoes have dropped. But one of the shoes that hasn't dropped yet is that there's a building conflict between the Kurds in the north and the Arabs. And the Kurds have a regional confederacy, Kurdistan, with their own parliament, prime minister, president, and military. In fact, any of you can fly to Erbil, the capital of Kurdistan, and get a visa at the airport from Kurdistan. Iraq, not involved. You could also go to Erbil and start a company, invest without, by your leave from Baghdad. No federal troops allowed to set foot on Kurdistan soil. I mean, Alabama should have it so good. This is an independent country, Kurdistan. We don't call it that because it would cause several wars. It's like Taiwan. Not an independent country, but it is. And a lot of Kurdish nationalists in Iraq are expansionists. They're not satisfied with the three provinces they now have, which they have combined into one regional confederacy. They want bits and pieces of other provinces. And those other provinces are also claimed by the Arabs. And they especially want the oil-rich city of Kirkuk. And Kirkuk province has become certainly majority Kurdish through immigration and so forth. And the Kurds had wanted a referendum in Kirkuk, which they would certainly win, because they flooded in a lot of Kurds. Some Kurds returned there having been expelled by Saddam. Others, I think, came volunteer. And then there's been an encouragement of Arabs to leave and so forth. But the Arabs are saying, over my dead body will Kurdistan annex Kirkuk. It produces a significant proportion of Iraqi petroleum. Arabs have a long presence there, and they don't want to be dragooned into Kurdistan. And so there have been tribal Arab groups that have threatened violence if this went forward. And in Diyala province, just to the south of Kurdistan, where there is a significant Kurdish population in the north of the province, there was actually hot firing between the Iraqi army and the Kurdistan Peshmerga paramilitary just a month ago. So this could go bad at any time. The Sunni Arabs, unlike what has been alleged about the change in law, don't feel enfranchised. They feel that after the U.S. invasion, they were disenfranchised. Some of them turned violent and waged an extremely horrific campaign of bombing, assassination against Shiites, against the U.S. military. But the most effective thing that the Sunni Arab guerrillas ever did involved killing no one. They blew up the sacred shrine of the 12th Imam and his father and grandfather in the northern city of Samarra, north of Baghdad. In the aftermath of this, the Shiites, who had restrained themselves despite many provocations to that point, started ethnically cleansing the Sunnis. They turned on them in very large numbers. And through summer of 2006, the death toll of civilians rose to as many as 3,000 a month. The Baghdad police actually had to establish a corpse patrol. I don't know what you had to do to get on the wrong side of your sergeant that you got assigned to go out at 6:30 in the morning with a cart and pick up the corpses that had shown up on the streets in the morning. Largely Sunni Arabs killed by Shiite death squads. A second round, as I said, of parliamentary elections were held in December of 2005. The Shiite fundamentalist parties won again, but in the aftermath, a new prime minister came to the fore because there was substantial dissatisfaction by all parties with the old prime minister, Ibrahim Jaafari. Nouri al-Maliki, a member of the Islamic Call Party. He had been the Damascus bureau chief of the revolutionary Islamic Call Party in the 80s and 90s. The Dawah Party helped to form Hezbollah in South Lebanon, the Iraqi Dawah. So I was amused when al-Maliki came to Washington in August of 2006 during the war between Lebanon and Israel. The Congress was insisting that al-Maliki be a good American ally and denounce Hezbollah. And of course he didn't. He said, well, you know, it's a humanitarian issue. And so I thought, they don't seem to realize, like, if not he, then, you know, his first cousin founded Hezbollah, and it was very unrealistic to expect him to denounce it. And as I mentioned, violence got so bad that I think there was a choice between the U.S. getting out or the U.S. Attempting one more set of tactics to reduce the violence. And it was decided by the Bush administration to send in 30,000 extra troops. In addition to which, and actually before that decision was made, the American generals on the ground began trying to woo Iraqi Sunni Arabs away from the Sunni fundamentalist groups that we call Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and to get them to take an American salary and to form neighborhood militias to fight the Sunni fundamentalists, many of them foreigners. And this had already begun to succeed in some measure before the troop escalation. But, and I would argue that both the troop escalation and the formation of these awakening councils among the Sunni Arabs were elements in the reduction of social violence. But I don't think they were very big elements. I think that the major thing that happened that reduced the monthly death toll from 3,000 to 400 or 500 nowadays was that the Shiites won the battle for Baghdad. And you can see this victory in a map published by the New York Times. The Washington Post had a similar one based on U.S. military statistics. In June of 2006, you can see that the Shiites are largely in the east and a little bit in the north. That's the yellow part of Baghdad. And then you have a lot of mixed neighborhoods. And then the Sunnis are largely in the west, although they're a bit in the center as well. In the aftermath of the massive ethnic cleansing campaigns of 2006-2007, by November of 2007, you can see that the yellow has taken over Baghdad. Those are the Shiites. Baghdad became, it was maybe 50-50 Sunni and Shiite when the U.S. took it in 2003. By this point, November 2007, it's 75%, 80% Shiite. And not only do U.S. military statistics indicate this vast social change, but a team at UCLA recently did a study of ambient light at night from Iraqi cities. And they found West Baghdad went dark around this time, and around a year before this, actually, in sort of December of 2006, and it never came back. It's still dark. So there's nobody living over there where the Sunnis used to live. I went and met some of them in Jordan this past summer. Why has the violence declined? Why are there so many fewer people being killed? Well, now you would have to drive for a while to find a Sunni to kill. They're gone. Moreover, there's still lots of Iraq that's violent. There's still violence every day in Baghdad. There are bombings, there are assassinations. And then in the provinces such as Diyala, Nineveh, which are still violent. The success of the surge, which probably wasn't mostly a success of the surge, hasn't been complete. I want to turn, as in my last set of comments, to the new assertiveness of the Maliki government in the past 6 months. Last spring, in March, Maliki decided to move against the Muqtada Sadr militia, the Mahdi Army, which is a major Shiite group, and which had a toehold, some significance, in the southern port city of Basra. Basra is the major province that produces the petroleum and from which petroleum is exported. So there's a lot of gasoline smuggling around Basra, which means that the money is going to the militias and not to the government. Now Maliki wanted to make a grab for those resources for the central government. So he sends the army down to fight the Sadrs, and initially faces some setbacks. Some of his military kind of likes the Mahdi army and doesn't want to fight them. And even there are pictures of them turning their weapons over to the Mahdi army. But especially those elements of the Iraqi military that came from the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq, the old Iraqi Shiite fundamentalist party that had been formed in Iran and received Iranian training and arms, those were willing to fight the Mahdi army, because the Mahdi army is kind of Iraqi nativist, you know, Iraqi, I mean, the Mahdi army is Iraqi nativist. It's like an urban street gang in the United States. So the Iran-backed, Iran-trained elements in the Iraqi army took them on and defeated them. And some kind of order was restored to Basra, and it was a great victory for al-Maliki. And then he moved on another southern city, Amara, and then he moved on East Baghdad itself, which is a big stronghold of the Mahdi army. And in each case, his troops managed to assert themselves to some extent. He did receive logistical and air support, close air support from the United States, without which probably these victories could not have been won. But for the first time since 2003, there was an Iraqi army that would stand and fight and make progress on the ground and take and hold territory. And al-Maliki had finally gotten a hold of that situation and asserted himself. This changes everything, because the old arguments against the U.S. getting out of Iraq were that there's no Iraqi army, there's nobody to maintain order, and so on and so forth. But if al-Maliki can do it, then why not let him? The other part of Maliki's assertiveness was that Iraq had been under receivership of the United Nations after the Gulf War. And there's a chapter of the United Nations Charter that allows for the United Nations Security Council essentially to oversee a country. And so Iraq was being overseen, and it had lacked sovereignty. And it was the United Nations Security Council that wrote up the mandate for multinational forces, including U.S. and British forces, to be in Iraq after the fall of the Saddam Hussein regime. The United Nations did not approve the war, did not approve the invasion, but the United Nations did recognize that in the aftermath of the overthrow of the Iraqi government, somebody had to keep order. And so they authorized the U.S. And British and other multinational forces to be there. And there therefore was a warrant in international law for military operations like Fallujah. They couldn't be just written off as war crimes because there was a U.N. Security Council mandate for them. But that mandate ends on December 31st. And unless the Iraqis go back to the United Nations Security Council and ask for an extension, which they're very reluctant to do, because they would like to be independent again. They'd like to be out from under the UN. So they thought the alternative to a further UN mandate would be a bilateral treaty between the United States and Iraq, which would specify the rules of engagement, which would specify the rules under which the U.S. military operated in Iraq. And one of the big issues was, for instance, say you have security guards, private contractors, who are cowboying around Baghdad and shoot up people. Believe it or not, it has happened. Are those security guards going to be tried in Iraqi courts for murder or manslaughter? Well, up until now, the answer has been no. But the Iraqis are saying, as of January 1st, the answer is going to be yes, for most categories of such security guards. I predict to you a massive exodus of security guards from Iraq. Then there's an issue of U.S. troops. Say you've got a U.S. soldier who's off base in the evening, and I don't know, you know, if there are any bars left in Baghdad, but say he gets in a bar fight and somebody gets killed. So would he be arrested and put before an Iraqi judge for murder or manslaughter? And the Bush administration's answer to that was absolutely not, under no conditions. And the Iraqis worked on them and said, well, okay, maybe under certain conditions. So Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani, the spiritual leader of the Iraqi Shiites, has insisted that any status of forces agreement be such that it asserts Iraqi sovereignty and extraterritoriality, or the immunity of foreign military and paramilitary forces, is one of the key issues over which there are difficult negotiations. They did a draft. The Iraqis now are not satisfied with the draft. It's being renegotiated, and it may well not be passed. So we may come to January 1st with no legal framework for U.S. troops to operate in Iraq. I think most likely the Iraqis will eventually go back to the UN. But Secretary of Defense Robert Gates has said, if that happens, U.S. troops would be confined to the base. And so you see how I'm saying that these events on the ground in the last 6 months have moved so rapidly as to make the political discourse in this country irrelevant. We're talking about will they be withdrawn or not, or under what timetable, or will we have bases in Iraq 100 years from now? The question is, would an American soldier be able to step off base on January 1st? It's a whole different scale on which to think. So, and then you could argue that, well, the next big thing is going to be the Arab-Kurdish struggle. But is that really something that the United States is going to be able to do anything about, that it would like to get in the middle of? I mean, this would be another Iraqi civil war, and I don't want to complicate things too much, but Turkey and Iran would come in. So, and Senator Hillary Clinton was even talking, when she was campaigning for president, she was talking about having a permanent U.S. military base in Kurdistan. Well, you can only be supplied in Kurdistan. It's in the north and it's rugged. You couldn't get supplies up there to U.S. troops from Kuwait. You can only really be supplied in Kurdistan from Turkey. So if you had a U.S. base in Kurdistan, in northern Iraq, and war broke out between the Iraqi Kurds and the Turks, then the U.S. troops would get supplied how? I really wouldn't advise bases in Kurdistan. So my argument has been, actually the Iraqi situation is now beyond U.S. control. The U.S. military is not in a position to assert itself on the major issues facing the future of Iraq. And U.S. soldiers are not policemen. I mean, how long are they going to be responsible for keeping order in Karada and Baghdad? Long-term U.S. military bases are impractical. I predict you I would say that the likelihood of there being long-term military bases in Iraq is maybe 1%. I have learned from the statisticians, if you predict in percentages, you can never be wrong. Grand Ayatollah Sistani would not put up with it. He's made it clear, his recent pronouncements on Iraqi sovereignty. At some point, Sistani will conclude that the Iraqis can get along without the Americans, that the next day wouldn't be chaos. And he will wake up in the morning and he will give an Islamic legal ruling, the fatwa. And he will say no U.S. troops, no foreign troops on Iraqi soil. He hasn't done it yet, but he's hinted around at it at various points. So I don't think the movers and the shakers in Iraq, the people with moral authority, are not going to acquiesce in this goal. There's an increasing movement for the reassertion of Iraqi sovereignty among Iraqi politicians and the public. People are tired of being essentially a colony of the United States or of the United Nations, however you think about it. I think whoever gets elected president is going to have a series of very difficult negotiations and very difficult choices in Iraq. And whatever happens, if the U.S. withdraws or doesn't withdraw, there could be substantial return of social violence for various reasons, the Arab-Kurdish struggle, there are Shiite divisions, there's a whole question of Iranian and Turkish involvement, and so forth. And so I'll just leave you with this thought that no war plan ever survives contact with the enemy.